There have been any number of mountaineering disasters over the years, but August 2nd, 2008 may have been the worst. At the end of that day, 11 climbers had died after a lip of ice collapsed, destroying the pathways they planned to use to return to their base camp. Graham Bowley tells the story of this fateful day and the circumstances that made it worse in his new book, No Way Down, Life and Death on K2. It's published by Harper. I'm very pleased that it brings Graham Bowley to our show today. Hi.
Hi, Lynn.
Now, refresh our memories about August 2008. What did the initial report say about the avalanche on K2?
The report started to come through, and it became clear in those early reports that some people were trapped at the summit of K2 in northern Pakistan. It wasn't clear what exactly had happened, but we knew some people were still up there.
Now, what is the appeal of K2? It's not the highest peak. Mount Everest is.
Mount Everest is the more well-known. It's slightly higher than K2. K2 is the second tallest mountain in the world, but it's far more dangerous for a number of reasons. It's further north. The weather is far more unpredictable, and the climbing is much more difficult. And so over the years, it's had this sort of historical allure for climbers, for real climbers. It's called the Mountaineer's Mountain. It's attracted only the best to it.
Where did it get the name K2 from?
This is very interesting. It was from British explorers and British empire builders. A couple of centuries ago, when they were expanding into this border territory, partly as part of the Great Game, and from a distance in northern India, one of these empire builders saw the mountain in the Karakoram range. So it was K for Karakoram, and it was the second one that he charted.
So it's almost like a technical name.
Right.
And that also makes it sound more daunting, doesn't it?
Well, it's so far from anywhere else. That's another reason why it's so difficult. So it didn't have a local name. Other mountains got numbers. But then the kind of native names were taken back, but K2 never was.
What's been the success rate of K2 climbs over the years?
It's pretty horrible, and climbers who go there know it. So, you know, less than...
Many deaths.
300 people have only climbed it in the 50 years since it was first conquered. Nearly 70 have died, more than 70 have died. So it's sort of the fraction is 1 in 4.
So it was actually conquered after Everest?
It was conquered in 1953, yeah, by an Italian team. Although it had also come to be known as the American Mountain because it had been the scene of several important climbs by American expeditions.
Is there a specific way you climb up this mountain?
You can go from the north, from China, or from the south, more popularly, from Pakistan. And there are two routes. One, the Abruzzi route, which is first kind of ascertained by an Italian group, or the Chezen. And in 2008, the climbers went up the south side from Pakistan on the Abruzzi and the Chezen route.
And there are certain areas that are well-known, the Bottleneck, the Traverse, the Death Zone.
That's right. That's what makes it so difficult. When you get to Camp 4, way up in the sky, you then set out on the final day of the ascent to the summit, and you have to go through these major obstacles. One, the Bottleneck, which is this 200-foot gully, which is truly frightening. And then hanging above it is this huge glacier called the Serac. And they go underneath that on a thing called the Traverse to the left, and then they go over the top and then up to the summit along the snowfields.
Did you cover this story for the New York Times?
I did. I was on the foreign desk when the first reports came through, and I was asked to write about it from New York, and I spoke to climbers who were actually on the mountain. I managed to get through to them on their satellite phones, and some had been keeping blogs. That's what makes it so interesting, sort of real time. You could see through the previous days what they'd been doing. Very different mountaineering today than it was in earlier decades. You can get these real voices from the mountain.
The first news account spoke of the ice fall and an avalanche, but hadn't things gone wrong even before the bad weather struck?
Yes, that's what made it so interesting. You know, this mountain attracted this kind of group of 30 of the best climbers in the world, and together they thought they could take this mountain on, this monster.
And these were the best climbers in the world because some of them were slower than others, weren't they?
Some of them were the best. They were very good. I don't think you go to K2 unless you are among the best. It's a very different demographic from, say, Everest. But they decided to cooperate and take on this monster, and the cooperation fell apart. And so even early on in the day, as the sun rose, as they set off towards the bottleneck, overcrowding of so many climbers together meant they were delayed and led to the first death and another death quickly afterwards. So two people had died by about 11, 12, and they still carried on.
That's before the avalanche. That was in the morning.
This is in the morning as they're going towards the summit. They carried on despite the delay and the deaths. They get to the top victoriously. 18 got to the top. That's when the avalanche struck.
There was also a problem with the porter, Jahan Beg, who tried to help Serbian climber's body down.
There are Pakistani guides and who help the kind of Western climbers. And
they're not Sherpas?
No, the Sherpas who come from Nepal, they're flown in, and they're on the mountain as well, and they're slightly higher paid and more experienced. Then there are the Pakistani guides who are trying to build their own life in this region and have taken to the mountain and the mountain industry. And Jahan Beg was one of them. As he came down, he tried to help a group of climbers that was bringing a Serbian climber down. And we think Jahan probably had altitude sickness through the lack of oxygen at that altitude, and he tripped and fell tragically.
Well, what about oxygen? Don't some people carry oxygen tanks? Is that considered wussy?
You're right. There's a hierarchy amongst the climbers. There's some that just want to take on this mountain on their own. They don't use oxygen. They even frown on the fixed ropes, which these teams did use. But in this particular climb, some were on oxygen, so they carried up tanks and had a mask over their faces, and some weren't. And the oxygen really helps and is a way of reducing the risks. But actually, when it fails, when it runs out, which it did in a few cases, you sort of plunged into this terrible world of oxygen deprivation, which makes it much worse.
Now, you mentioned there were a number of groups. Is that typical? Do a bunch of different groups go up? Are they competing with each other when a climb is attempted?
I think decades ago, there'd be one or two expeditions on K2 in the early decades. But these days, you know, climbing is more prevalent. There are more professional climbers and very good ones, and they're attracted to this mountain. And so there were 10 on this mountain gathered around base camp. And usually they would have gone up one at a time, but the weather had been so bad that summer that they hadn't been able to. So they've been gathered and gathered. Eventually the skies opened and they all decided to go together. So these 10 of different nationalities, there were Koreans and Dutch, French, an American group, and they all went together thinking that they could cooperate, and it fell apart.
Did they coordinate at all to make sure that the fastest climbers were at the front, things like that?
Yeah, they did. And they divided up the kind of responsibilities of bringing rope and very precise what they each needed to take. And then a lead group set off early in the morning of mainly Sherpas and Pakistani guides to fix these fixed ropes up on this final ascent through the bottleneck. But the cooperation hadn't really worked, and they were missing equipment, and this led to their own delay. Even the fastest climbers were delayed.
My guest is Graham Bulley, whose book, No Way Down, Life and Death on K2, is published by Harper. You said that there was a kind of a groupthink that developed.
Yeah, I think there were so many together. I think you're right. There were so many together that they felt safety in numbers. And the day was so beautiful. It was really beautiful up there, and they carried on thinking that if everybody else was carrying on, everything was okay. But in fact, it wasn't.
But in most of the climbs of this sort, isn't there one person who's really in charge, who makes the major decisions? That wasn't happening here?
In each of the individual teams, there was a leader. And so if a team had been on its own, that leader would have made a decision. And for example, the Americans turned back.
Just decided it was too dangerous?
Yeah, they set off late and they saw the first – yeah, they'd seen the delay in the bottleneck ahead of them, and they said this was going to be too late in the day. They shouldn't carry on because they would be coming back down in the darkness, so they turned back cleverly. But others in this group carried on, and because there were so many teams together, there were many leaders and not one in particular.
What time did the first climber reach the summit?
There was a Spanish climber, a very talented Spanish climber, who kept himself apart from everybody else, and he reached the summit first at about 3 o'clock and came back down. But the rest carried on and summited after him. He tells these amazing stories of passing this line of climbers sort of straggling to the top. They reached the top from 5 p.m. and the last one's at 8 p.m., just as the sun was setting.
Oh, so that's rather late. It's hard to go back down when it's that dark.
It's late. It's cold. They know it's going to be dark, but they had set these fixed ropes up to just below the summit, which they thought they could rely on to get them back down again. They'd just come down, clip on, and it'd be like a railroad taking them back down to the safety of the
markers. It's like leaving a trail of breadcrumbs.
Well, it's actually fixed ropes. It's like ropes that you actually clip onto so that, you know, you're protected.
Well, I would think that getting down is a lot more dangerous than getting up.
It's the most difficult
part. But after all, gravity is playing a part in all of that.
Right. And also you're tired. You're very cold. You've been out without oxygen in many cases for many hours.
Are you also overconfident because you've already reached the summit?
Yeah.
You've achieved your goal?
There's that elation. And seeing the people and talking, seeing the photographs of the people on the summit and hearing them talk about it, seeing the video of it, there's just this amazing elation. I think that must add to it.
So how many of the deaths on K2 tend to occur when people are climbing down? The majority?
Yeah. Yeah.
What was the first natural disaster that struck on August 2nd? What caused the avalanche?
It's this... The Serac is the lip of this glacier which hangs at the top of the mountain, and each year it inches forward. And it's huge, and some years bits crack off and fall down. It's unpredictable. But for many years it had been quite quiet. Although climbers know that it's a risk and they look up at it, and some people call it the motivator. It gets you going and you want to get out from it really quickly. But this, perhaps the temperature, it had been very hot during the day, then suddenly very cold at night. It happened about 9 p.m., just as it was dark and freezing again.
Does it make noises?
In one very sad story, there was a great a Norwegian climber who was coming down, a woman called Cecilia Skog, with her husband, and she recounts how this collapsed and she amid this tremendous roar, and it killed her husband in front of her. So, yes, it's a terrible sound.
And when was this happening? Was there still a little daylight when the avalanche began?
It was at 9 p.m., so it was dark. It just the sun had set, and it had just fallen dark, and they were going down with their headlamps switched on, clipped onto these ropes.
And were they in the immediate path of the avalanche?
The Norwegian team, Cecilia, her husband Rolf, and another climber called Lars Nessa, they were at the lead of the descent. And so they were in the immediate path of this collapse.
So it's not only the collapse that's affecting you; it's also affecting the face of the mountain. All of those markers that they had, those fixed ropes, disappeared underneath the ice.
There was no way down. They got to the people falling behind. Some didn't know what had happened ahead of them. Didn't know what had happened to the Norwegians. But they came to this point where the avalanche had swept the early climbers away and also swept away these fixed lines, these markers. They couldn't get down without them, they thought.
You write about a man named Wilco van Roelgen, a Dutchman who was trapped above the bottleneck. What happened to him?
A tremendous Dutch climber, very strong-willed. He came down through the darkness and couldn't find the ropes down, didn't know what had happened, and decided to stay out overnight, which in itself is a huge risk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's deadly. It can be deadly.
Did he have oxygen?
He didn't have oxygen, no. And he was suffering. He'd fallen asleep already as he came down. He just kind of collapsed. He got himself up and was pulling him down. Couldn't find the ropes. Decided to stay. Found two other climbers that were, the technical term is bivouacking, out under the open on the lip of the, right on the top of the Serac, not knowing what had happened. Somebody had heard some weeping. They didn't know what that was. They'd find out later the next morning. But Wilco and the two other climbers stayed there overnight. And when the sun came up, they set out over the lip of the Serac and discovered some terrible things, including no ropes. And Wilco would eventually get down 2 days later.
Just because he was experienced?
He was tremendously experienced, very strong-willed. He got lost, had to spend a second day out in the open, called his wife in the Netherlands to get direction down, and she helped him guide him down.
I assume that people experience physical damage despite the fact that they're wearing clothing that is made to protect right. them against the elements.
Right. Yeah, Wilco lost his toes through frostbite, very cold. So did another climber, an Italian climber. Hands, digits, people lose noses on these mountains.
The book reads as if you were part of the expedition. Have you ever climbed?
I went to K2. I am not a climber. I wasn't a climber. But I kind of stepped into this world, which was so fascinating, these people, to know why they did it and what they did. So I went to K2 last year, which had its political risks because there was uproar in the Swat Valley with the Taliban. And to get to K2, you have to go around the Swat Valley. That was very interesting. And but then when you actually
and get, the alternative is to go to China, you say,
which is difficult and is not the kind of the main route. And then you join the climbers as they trek in. You take 6 days to trek in over sort of this blasted terrain in northern Pakistan, in Baltistan. And then eventually you arrive, sort of your lungs pumping through with no oxygen. You can't sleep. You have no appetite. And you arrive at K2 base camp, which was tremendous for me because I'd heard so much about it. And you see this tremendous monster of a mountain.
So even at the base camp, there is thin oxygen?
Oh, yeah. 16,000 feet. There's not much there. You're on a glacier which pops and cracks at night as it shifts. And you can see, you know, there's death in the air, actually, because right you kind of camp right next to this memorial to the dead called the Gilkey Memorial, named after an American who died there.
What about the surviving climbers? Have they given up any thoughts of climbing K2?
Well, I've got to know them very well, and I traveled the world and interviewed them. Some, you know, immediately afterwards, some swore never to go back, but some now want to. Some are continuing climbing. It's what they do. It's what they love. Cecilia Skog, the great Norwegian climber I mentioned, she said she's never going back. She hates K2.
But Alberto Zarain told you that he's going to prepare to go back. How long will it take him?
I don't know if he's going back to K2. He probably will. He's such a strong climber, but he's already back climbing mountains. He's been on other great peaks already.
And if you've lost a few toes, can you still climb a mountain?
I wouldn't know, but apparently yes. I know some, the Italian Marco Confortola, he's been back trying to climb Lhotse, another big mountain.
Graham Bowley's book, No Way Down, Life and Death on K2, is published by Harper. He'll be giving a reading and signing books this next Wednesday, July 21st at 7 p.m. at the Rubin Museum. That's on 17th Street. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Lon.